If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. What exactly made King Alfred great? Did he really burn any cakes? And why should we care about documents that record early medieval land transactions? Dr. Robert Gallagher has been studying the Welsh churchman Asser, who wrote a biography of Alfred, The Life of King Alfred. He spoke to our content director, David Musgrove, about his findings. If after listening to this podcast, you want to learn more about the early medieval period, this week is Vikings Week on our website, historyextra.com. We've got plenty more material there, including articles on Harald Hardrada, the Danelaw, and Viking funerals. You can find all of that at historyextra.com/Vikings.
Today I am joined by Dr. Robert Gallagher, who is lecturer in early medieval history at the University of Kent, where he works in the Centre for Medieval and Early Modern Studies. He's written an interesting article in the English Historical Review entitled Asser and the Writing of West Saxon Charters. So we're going to talk about Asser and King Alfred. Now, for listeners who haven't heard of Asser, he wrote The Life of King Alfred. King Alfred the Great, the famous West Saxon early English king who reigned in the 9th century. So we're going to talk a bit about Asser, and we're going to talk a little bit about King Alfred as well, no doubt. So Rob, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you very much for having me.
So first up, who was Asser? What do we actually know about him?
Okay, so Asser was a 9th century Welsh member of the church. He was alive in the second half of the 9th century and the very early 10th century. And the reason that he is well known to historians and so historically significant is because, as you said, he wrote The Life of King Alfred, which is the earliest surviving biography we have of an English king. Most of what we know about Asser comes from the information that he tells us in that text, in The Life of King Alfred. And we know that he grew up and was educated at St. David's in southwest Wales. And later on, probably after he'd written The Life of King Alfred, because he doesn't mention it, he becomes the Bishop of Sherborne, which is a West Saxon bishopric in the southwest of England.
Right. And then the actual Life of King Alfred itself, this document, can you briefly introduce us to that? What are its key points and what's its sort of general style and approach? And I suppose, importantly, what language was it written in to start with?
Yeah, so the Life of King Alfred, I mean, it's an extraordinary text. It's very unique in many ways. It is a biography of the West Saxon King Alfred, who is later known as Alfred the Great. Alfred himself was king of the West Saxons from 871 to 899. And remarkably, this biography of him was written while he was still alive. It tells us a huge amount about Alfred as a person. We get a real sense of him as an individual. But it also tells us an enormous amount about the political, social, and cultural developments of the time. In terms of the structure, it starts off by it addresses Alfred himself, and then it tells us about his ancestry, and then it moves on to his childhood. In terms of the content, it then switches to a focus on Viking attacks and the military activity that's taking place in the mid to late 9th century in Britain. But then it later gives us more information about Alfred as a person and as a ruler. So we get a real sense of him as someone who is very keen on education and learning. He's very concerned for his own spiritual well-being as well as his subjects. And we're also told information about how he governed his kingdom, which in many ways seems to be pretty exceptional in terms of what he was doing. But in terms of the text, so that's the sort of structure. And in terms of language, it was written in Latin. This was a text, as I said, written by someone from Wales who it's highly likely, though we don't know for certain, that Asser's native language would have been Welsh, so not Old English, the language of King Alfred himself. So in that multilingual context, this text was written in Latin.
And just that moves us on to the question of what languages would have been spoken in Alfred's court. So as you said, you've got a Welshman, Asser, who would have grown up speaking a different language, a completely different language to Old English. Mm. But then he's writing in Latin, the language of the church. So can we imagine like a court where numerous languages are being used and spoken?
Definitely. I mean, I think the dominant language certainly would have been Old English, which is the ancestor language of the language that we're speaking right now, because that was the language that was the vernacular, the primary vernacular of the West Saxons, so Alfred's kingdom, but also the Mercians and the people of Kent and other areas that King Alfred also had political dominion over. But there would have been other people at his court who were speaking different languages, and certainly Old English wouldn't have been their first language. So Asser is a clear example of this, of someone who was from a Celtic-speaking region. We know also that there were people from Francia, from both East and West Francia at Alfred's court, so speaking Romance and Germanic languages. We know that there were also people from Ireland who visited, as well as people from Scandinavia. So definitely this is a space that was multilingual at various points in time. And as you said, Latin was the language of the church to an extent, but it was also the lingua franca. It was the language that most people, regardless of where they had come from in Western Europe, would have had some exposure to.
Do we know whether King Alfred himself understood Latin?
If we believe Asser, yes, he almost miraculously attains Latin literacy pretty much overnight. I think that we should probably take, when Asser tells us things about the king, I think we need to take everything not at face value, to put it. He's certainly aiming to create an impression of an idealized king to some extent. We don't know for certain his levels of Latin literacy, but it is claimed that Alfred personally translated several texts from Latin into Old English. There is the big question of how much personal involvement he actually had in these translation programs, or whether his name was put on top of these translations once they were complete. So we don't know for certain, but my sense is that his concern with education and learning, I sense a sort of an authenticity to it. So I can imagine that, yes, he was interested in learning the language of scripture. So I can imagine that, yes, certainly he would have, I think he did probably learn some Latin, but I think it's fair to say he wouldn't have been able to speak it fluently.
He was supposed to have been bookish, wasn't he, Alfred? And you have the fantastic artifacts, the ace stalls, these little the Alfred jewels, which were they supposed to be bookmarks or something like that, weren't they?
We don't know for certain. We don't know for certain. So yeah, these ace stalls that are referred to in a different text from Alfred's reign, that he sends out these ace stalls to people within his kingdom that are associated with the promotion of learning. So it's thought that these were some sort of jeweled items that you might have a pointer on that you use to guide reading. And as you said, the most famous example of that is this so-called Alfred jewel, which is in the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. It certainly fits the story and the impression that we get of Alfred as someone who is seeking education not only for himself but for his subjects. And he seems to be a ruler who is very concerned not only with the physical safety of his subjects in terms of fighting off Viking attacks, but also their spiritual safety and well-being. And it seems to be very much tied up with that.
Listeners should check out that the Alfred jewel. I'm sure it'll be on the Ashmolean website. So it's a beautiful artifact.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's definitely on the website, yes.
we've gone off track a bit. You mentioned something earlier in your first answer that we think the life of King Alfred was written at the time of Alfred's reign. How do we know that?
So there is a reference within the text that suggests that Asser was writing in the year 893. That doesn't mean that he began or completed this text during that year, but it provides a point during which he was in the process of writing this. But there have been question marks about the authenticity over this text for ever since the 19th century onwards. I should say that the vast majority of people do accept it as authentic, but every now and again, this conversation re-emerges. And the reason for that, the reason that there is space for this question mark over its authenticity is because we don't have a late 9th century copy of this text. The only known medieval copy of it was produced around the year 1000, and it was destroyed in a fire in the 18th century. So the only reason that this text has survived is because of later copying. And because we have that, therefore, that chronological gap, that disjuncture between the writing of it and its preservation, rightly so, we need to think about, well, is this actually what it claims to be?
It wasn't just any fire that was destroyed, was it? The Cotton Library fire, which was the terrible bonfire of manuscripts. It was the one where Beowulf manuscript got singed, wasn't it?
Yeah, for any person who works on early medieval Britain, the deeply traumatic fire of the Cotton fire. It was one of several victims in terms of manuscripts that were destroyed, unfortunately, at that time.
So do we know why Asser wrote this? I mean, one can imagine that if he was at the court of King Alfred, he wrote it to celebrate the monarch. But is it as simple as that?
It's a really good question. Why did he write this? I mean, I guess that in thinking about the motives behind it, several approaches we might take. We might think about what were the models that may have inspired Asser? What other texts existed that Asser seemed to have been written and inspired by? Might that give us a hint of his motivations? In that regard, we know that amongst the literature that Asser was familiar with was Einhard's Life of Charlemagne, which was an earlier biography of the Frankish Emperor Charlemagne. So one of the motivations may well be wanting to emulate the Carolingian esteem associated with Charlemagne. Beyond that, thinking more about the immediate political context to Asser writing, thinking about who he might have been writing for, who was the primary audience for this. Yes, he addresses, right at the beginning of it, he addresses Alfred. And I think we should imagine that he wrote this with the expectation that Alfred may read what he's saying about him. But it's widely understood by researchers that also that Asser probably was also writing, at least in part, for a Welsh audience. The reason that this has been suggested on numerous occasions is because of the way that he describes what's going on in the text, particularly geographic locations. It's really interesting that he does this because there seems to be an appreciation that his audience might not necessarily know where he's talking about in other parts of Britain. And so on several occasions, he provides the place name in multiple languages. He's not entirely consistent about this, but there are instances where we get the place name in Old English. We also get it in Welsh as well as in Latin. In that regard, thinking about, well, what's going on in Wales at this point in time, why might there be a Welsh audience for this? As Asser tells us, from the 880s onwards, the kingdoms within Wales, the majority of them had recognised Alfred as an overlord of some regard. It's not quite clear the nature in reality of that political situation. So one way of reading it, therefore, in terms of motivation and audience is that this text is an act of persuasion to persuade people that, yeah, Alfred's a good ruler. We should be on board with this political situation.
Do we know anything about the relationship between Asa and Alfred? Is that, does he talk about that at all in his manuscript?
He does. Quite unusually so when you look at other early medieval biographies, that Asa plays a particularly prominent role within his own narrative. There's a scene in particular that is surprisingly sort of intimate in insight into their working relationship. We're told about how Asa is reading texts aloud to Alfred in his royal chamber, and how he's the king asks him to copy out texts for him that he's particularly inspired by. So much of our impression of their relationship comes from the life, but we do know from external evidence there is other evidence for their relationship, primarily from a text called the Old English Pastoral Care, which is one of those texts that I mentioned earlier that was translated from Latin into Old English, and that's attributed to King Alfred. And that text has been transmitted with a couple of different prefaces, one in prose and one in verse. And the prose one is particularly famous because it speaks from Alfred's own voice. And he mentions how he talks about how he personally translated this with the help of various people. And he name checks Asa as one of those people who helped him translate this text from Latin into Old English.
Okay, so just thinking a little bit about how important this document is, as we talked about, you know, we don't have the surviving copies, and so we're going on later copies of it, annotated editions and the like. But if we hadn't got any record of this life at all, how much would we know about Alfred and his life? Would our knowledge of the king be much reduced?
Yes, we would know less for certain, not just about Alfred, but also the contemporary political situation. I should say that, I mean, Alfred's reign in terms of the text that it produced is exceptional, not just for the production of this biography of the king. We also have those translations, which provide us with external evidence that seems to confirm that, yes, this was a king who was very concerned with learning, literacy, and education in his reign. So even without the life, I would say that Alfred's reign would be extraordinary. On top of that, he's only one of two pre-conquest English kings for whom we have a surviving will. He's exceptional in many different ways, but certainly the life of King Alfred sits at the heart of why his reign is so exceptional and so fascinating to study. Because unlike those other texts that survive from his reign, it's that narrative, it's that anecdotal insights that we get from it that are so unique, that we get a much stronger sense of Alfred as a person, but also in terms of the information it gives us about what's going on in Wales, and that specifically that political relationship between the West Saxons and the Welsh kingdoms, particularly the southern Welsh kingdoms. We would know very little about that otherwise.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Medieval Latin literature is a deeply international body of literature. I mean, particularly from England in the 10th and 11th centuries, the majority of known Latin authors who were writing at that point in time had not been born in England. This is a very international world.
And just talking about what it tells us and what we can learn from it, then what sort of commonly held views about Alfred are down to Asa's life?
I think the life has probably had a very big impact on why Alfred ended up being called the Great. And this isn't an epithet that he is given during his lifetime. It's much later. I believe it's the 16th century when the first surviving examples of it are from. Why is he great? We can talk about his military successes against Viking forces, which are documented by Asa, but also by other contemporary material, particularly the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. It's the cultural side to things, the educational, the spiritual concerns of the king that really come to the fore, I think, particularly prominently within the life of King Alfred, that we probably wouldn't have as clear a sense of without it. It's probably also worth acknowledging those things that are popularly associated with Alfred that aren't mentioned by Asser. And the one thing I suppose to flag here is that, unfortunately, Asser doesn't have anything about baking cakes at all. And that's the story of King Alfred burning the cakes isn't something that is attested until the 11th century. So we don't know if he was a baker or not in terms of contemporary evidence.
I mean, that is very disappointing. I was going to grill you on that right now. So this is by the by, I suppose, well, conversation. But so the baking cakes episode when he was supposedly stranded in the marshes in Somerset while the Vikings were rampaging all around, not attested in his lifetime.
No, I'm really sorry. It's not until the 11th century. I think the earliest version of that story of any sort is an 11th century anonymous hagiography of Saint Neot, which mentions this as part of that narrative. But there is unfortunately no late 9th century evidence to suggest that King Alfred was a baker.
Right. Well, Bake Off fans, that's bad news. But
it is. I'm sorry. Yeah.
There we go. But so broadly speaking, it portrays Asser's life of King Alfred portrays him in a positive light. That's what you're saying.
Definitely. Yes. Asser was clearly a big fan of the person he was writing about, and I mean it's interesting that Asser does, even though this is clear. Panegyric. It's clearly trying to praise.
What is panegyric?
Oh, please. Sorry. Praise literature. This is clearly praise literature. But he does try and note some personal conflicts that Alfred deals with. And he talks strikingly about Alfred's illnesses. He's someone who has physical ailments, but he also talks about his own personal conflicts with this and his carnal desires as well, it mentions. The sense that this is the person, I think Asser is striving to get across that this is a person, this is a human, this is with their own personal sort of experiences and struggles. But it is overwhelmingly positive. Yes.
Yeah, so it sounds quite as if it is quite a personal. Is it almost journalistic in its approach, or is that a completely anachronistic thing to say when we're talking about this sort of manuscript?
I mean, what do you mean by journalistic?
right back at me. I mean, a journalist would look out for the personal element in a story, wouldn't he or she?
Yeah, and I think that there's definitely a sense of that. As I said, certain chapters of it are Asser has taken the information from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, and it's just stating that this happened in this year. But then it does switches its focus, and it changes tone at times to be surprisingly intimate. And so we do get an insight to him in being emotionally invested and motivated in what he's doing as a ruler.
So we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that we don't have a surviving copy of the original. Mm. But has the story that's told in this life, has that been popular ever since the 9th, 10th century when it first came down, or is it did it sort of die away and then come back?
Well, I think this adds to why there have been questions about its authenticity, because we don't have a huge number of medieval manuscripts of this text. It doesn't seem to be a text that had huge circulation. It didn't become a standard text that was read in classrooms. We know of certain later authors that seem to have known of it. We can tell that because of the information they contain in their own texts, but also the phrasing that they use in their own texts. So that we know of certain moments in time where there are authors. There's very recent evidence uncovered by David Callan, Rebecca Tobbas, that points to a Welsh poet in the first half of the 10th century knowing this text. Then we fast forward to the later 10th century one individual, Bertforth of Ramsey, seems to have known of it. And then we move forward into the 11th century, and I can think of other individual examples of authors who seem to have known of this, but it's not, there isn't a sense of it becoming a bestseller in medieval Britain.
So it's not a Geoffrey of Monmouth Arthurian tales type thing?
No, unfortunately not, no.
Okay, now, so we've talked there a fair bit about this life of King Alfred, which is known about and which people have obviously been researching for a long time, and it's an important document with those reservations you just described about the life of King Alfred. Now, but speaking about your research specifically that you've just been doing, you've made some interesting observations, and it requires us to understand charters because that's what you're referencing. So charters are another documentary source that comes down to us from the time of King Alfred and indeed earlier. Just tell us what a charter is and how we should understand them.
Charters are amazing. They are a source of huge amounts of information for us about the history of early medieval England. So a charter is a document that records a donation of land, very simply. And the vast majority of charters that have survived from the early medieval period are royal charters, otherwise known as royal diplomas, they're sometimes called. And these are recording donations by an individual king to an individual or an institution. We have charters surviving from the 7th century all the way up to the 11th century and beyond. So this isn't something that's exclusive or unique to Alfred's reign. But Alfred, like the vast majority of his predecessors and successors as a king, issued charters giving land to individuals within his kingdom.
So the way you describe them there, that you make them sound like they must be pretty dry documents, not in the same vein as the life of King Alfred you just talked about.
At first glance, I would say. I say they're a type of material that once you give them time to speak to you, that they can tell you a huge amount of information, not only about that individual relationship between the king and the person they're giving the land to, because they're also, they normally contain a list of witnesses to the agreement. And these witnesses are confirming that, yes, this has happened. It very much speaks to the culture of consensus and consent that surrounded early medieval English kingship, particularly at royal assemblies. And in those witness lists, we can therefore track who is there. We can identify people and their careers. And also in terms of the language of these documents, most of which are in Latin, particularly the royal ones, the ones that aren't royal charters sometimes are written in Old English instead. But they can tell us a huge amount, not only in terms of those practical agreements that are being made between people, but also in terms of political aspirations and the ideologies of the people. How is the king being described in these charters? It can tell us a huge amount about the conversations going on at the court and what they aspired to be as rulers. At first glance, admittedly, they often don't contain much narrative information. So it takes a bit more digging down into them to get to the juicy stuff.
Okay, and you have been digging down into them, and you have got to the juicy stuff. So, sort of very briefly, in layman's terms, give us a sense of how what you've worked out about Asa and one of these charters specifically.
So, this is part of a wider project that I've been doing, looking at Latin texts written in England what we might call the long 10th century, so from the 9th to the 11th centuries. And I've been particularly interested in looking at the use of more unusual phrasing and vocabulary to see if we can uncover new connections between texts. And so that my research project hasn't been specifically in search of texts related to Asa. This has just been a sort of happy result of this, that I've identified one surviving charter that has an unusually large number of phrases and pieces of vocabulary that are very idiosyncratic and and otherwise we might assume can be found in the life of King Alfred.
So in your phrasing in your article, you talk about lexical echoes, which is quite a nice turn of phrase there. So you're basically saying that you think Asser himself wrote one of these charters?
In trying to consider all the possible scenarios, that is the one that I have landed on and think is the most likely situation here. I should say that this one particular charter, wasn't issued by Alfred. It was issued after. So Alfred died in 899, and this charter was issued in 904. So it was issued by Alfred's successor and son, Edward the Elder. And yes, it contains, and it's recording an exchange of lands between Edward the Elder and the Bishop of Winchester. But it has all these echoes, well, as I said, lexical echoes of the life of King Alfred, which at first I thought, okay, great, that's interesting. This might be evidence for someone having read the life of King Alfred really early on. And any evidence of the reception of this text is rare. So I thought, woohoo, great. But then I looked into this further, and very fortunate in that there are three other charters that were issued in 904 at the same place. One might be from a different meeting, but three of them seem to have been produced for the same royal assembly. And what was exciting for me is when looking at the witness lists, I saw that in the three other charters from 904 from this place, Asser was in the witness lists, but he wasn't in the witness list for this charter, which is pretty weird. And so the explanation, I think, is that it's because he wasn't a witness for this document, it's because he was the person writing it.
And is there anything particularly interesting or unique about the charter itself or the contents of it?
So another Asser connection within it is that one of the parcels of land that have been exchanged within this agreement is at Banwell. And Banwell is a place that is named within the life of King Alfred as an estate that was given to Asser by King Alfred at an earlier time. Clearly by 904, this is in the hands. This Asser is no longer in possession of this because he's not mentioned as one of the people in this agreement. So we don't know at what point Asser may have relinquished this estate, but it adds to the sense of he may have had a vested interest in this agreement that was issued in 904.
Okay, so if you're correct that Asser had a hand in this charter, why should we care about that?
Well, I suppose the headline is it's doubling the corpus of texts written by Asser, who is one of the most famous authors from early medieval Britain. It tells us more about his activities and career, particularly after Alfred dies in 899. He's still around at Edward's court. And more importantly, I mean, we knew he was still around because he appears in the witness list for several charters. But this also tells us that he's actually writing Latin, probably under the patronage of the king. So it fleshes out our sense of Asser's relationship with Edward, his career after Alfred dies, potentially over, I mean, yes, he's writing in 893. We don't know if and when he actually finishes the life, but this is over 10 years later. So this is a sustained relationship that he's having with the West Saxon king. But more generally, one thing about charters from early medieval England is that they are, for the most part, anonymous. They don't normally tell us who writes them. And this gives us a sense of not only identifying one known historic individual who wrote a charter, but also thinking about Asser and his status at this point in time. By 904, he is the Bishop of Sherborne. And Sherborne is one of the two historic sees of the Kingdom of Wessex. So this is one of the most significant, high-powered roles in the church within the West Saxon kingdom. So it tells us, it's a hint at the involvement of bishops in the writing of charters. And I think more profoundly, potentially, thinking about who is creating the voice of the king and the involvement of bishops and members of the church in this, potentially. But then also thinking about Asser's status as a Welshman. Medieval Latin literature is a deeply international body of literature. I mean, particularly from England in the 10th and 11th centuries, the majority of known Latin authors who were writing at that point in time had not been born in England. This is a very international world. And I think this brings the Charter Corpus more firmly into that, getting that sense of this is a product of a deeply internationally interconnected world and cultural phenomenon.
Now, Asser died, I think, in 909 AD, is that right?
Yes, 908 or 909. I think that the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles says 909. Okay. One of those 2 years, probably 909.
So is there any, you've done this research on this charter and you've been looking at charters more generally, as you said. Is there any chance that you're going to identify Asser's hand in other charters? Is that possible?
I don't think I'm going to find Asser, unfortunately, in any other charters, because not with the same level of high probability that he wrote this. We do have a charter that was written slightly later, soon before he died, where he is the beneficiary of the charter. And it's possible that he wrote that one. I don't think I'm going to find any more from Asser because I'd like to think I've been pretty thorough in going through the corpus. But I invite others to see if they can find another one. But there is the potential for moving forward into the 10th century. There is certainly a lot more work that can and should be done on this. That there are certainly more discoveries to be made within the charters.
Are you going to work out the identity of Athelstan A?
Oh, I wish. So Athelstan A, for people less familiar with charters, so he's an anonymous author who had exclusive control and wrote royal charters for King Athelstan for about 7 years. And we don't know who this person is. And there have been various suggestions, but we've yet to uncover the definitive piece of evidence that unveils who Athelstan A is. But he was very exceptional, or she, in terms of the literary ambitions of them. Athelstan A's diplomas are very verbose, very wordy, in quite an extreme way. So I'd love to know who the personality behind them was. But we shall see.
Athelstan, of course, was Alfred's grandson. And I should say, I'm making myself sound much more educated than I am. I only know about Athelstan A because I went to a talk by Michael Wood last week where he talked about it. But it's fascinating, isn't it, to interrogate these charters and diplomas and learn stuff from them. So finally, Rob, does this shed any further light on the life of King Alfred or on the personality of King Alfred?
On the life of King Alfred as a text, I would like to think that this adds further to our certainty that this is a text of the late 9th century. And so we can be even more confident in using it as a source for exploring Alfred's life and his reign. And it's an extraordinary text that pretty much every time I read it, I spot something new that I hadn't really noticed or thought about before. It's a great text for research and for teaching. I mean, it's amazing where discussions with students can go because it's something I hadn't really thought about before. So I would like to think that it's contributed to that sense. And in terms of what it tells us further about Alfred, I mean, we might think that more about what exactly those scholars like Asser were doing at Alfred's court during his lifetime. Unfortunately, I haven't found in any of the charters that Alfred actually issued clear evidence that Asser wrote any of them. But thinking about what their roles were within that world at the court, what were they doing on a day-to-day basis, I think this discovery is something that, for me, confirms suspicions that, yes, this is the sort of activity they might be doing, that they might be writing these Latin charters. I think they were probably also writing letters that were sent to international correspondents in Latin, because who had these skills? That's one of the questions, one of the issues for Alfred, that there were relatively few people with those levels of Latin literacy. And that's why he brought these scholars in into his court in the first place. So I think it adds flesh to that understanding of what they're doing in the 890s in particular.
Okay, and finally, if any of our listeners are encouraged to go and read a copy of The Life of King Alfred, having listened to this conversation, is there a particular edition that is a good one to go to? And how should you sort of frame your reading of a document like that? How do you approach reading an early medieval document of that nature?
Well, in terms of the Latin text, the edition was produced in 1904, which by W.H. Stevenson, which remains the edition for looking at the Latin of it, because basically he did such a good job of producing it. In terms of translations, there is the Penguin Classics translation by Michael Lappage and Simon Keynes, which is the one that is the standard one to look at. So it's very, very accessible. I'm sure there are lots of secondhand copies, and even the new copy is pretty inexpensive. So yeah, I strongly encourage people to go and have a look at the translation and see what they make of it themselves, because I think it's such a remarkable text, and each person I think will have their own, kind of take something individual away from it.
That was Dr. Robert Gallagher of the Centre for Medieval and Early Modern Studies at the University of Kent. And as I mentioned earlier, if you're into early medieval history and you want to find out more about the Vikings, be sure to check out our Vikings-themed week on historyextra.com. You can find all of the material on that at historyextra.com/Vikings. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Tune in tomorrow when Zoe Playden will be exploring the story of a top secret legal case that transformed the experiences of transgender people.